Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. This year, Tech Policy Press is hosting 9 reporting fellows. These individuals, who are located around the world, from India to Spain to Brazil to the US and beyond, bring a variety of experiences and expertise to their work. One of those fellows is Anika Collier-Navaroli. Anika is an award-winning writer, lawyer, and researcher focused on the intersections of technology, media, policy, and human rights. She's currently a senior fellow at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University and the McGurn Senior Fellow for Media Integrity at the Consortium on Trust in Media and Technology at the University of Florida. For the past decade, her work has spanned from law firms and think tanks to advocacy organizations and senior policy positions at Twitter and Twitch. For her fellowship, Anika is conducting a series of podcast discussions like the one you'll hear today, which she's dubbed Through to Thriving. These conversations are intended to help us imagine possible futures for tech and tech policy, for democracy, and for society beyond the moment we are in. For this third episode in the series, Anika spoke with Dr. Timnit Gebru. Timnit is the founder and executive director of the Distributed Artificial Intelligence Research Institute, or DARE. Here's Anika to take it from here.
Welcome, y'all, and thank you for joining us again for this special series of podcast conversations called Through to Thriving. My name is Anika Collier-Navaroli, and I am your host and a fellow here at Tech Policy Press. And I am talking to some amazing folks about what we can put our focus and our energy into now so that we can get through this moment and to a place of a thriving and better future. So today, I'm going to be talking about building tech that serves and honors our elders with the amazing Dr. Timnit Gebru. Timnit, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you.
Good to see you, and good to talk to you, too. For any folks who may be listening to a Tech Policy Press podcast and for some reason have no idea who you are, would you introduce yourself to us?
So my name is Timnit Gebru. Timnit means wish in Tigrinya. I think that's relevant for our conversation today. That's my mother tongue. It's the first language I learned how to speak. It's a language spoken, Tigrinya is a language spoken in Eritrea and also the northern Ethiopian region of Tigray. And I mean, my job is I'm the founder and executive director of DARE, and DARE stands for the Distributed Artificial Intelligence Research Institute.
Well, thank you again for joining us. I want to talk a little bit about the first time that I actually spoke with you. I don't know if you remember this conversation, but I promise it's going to be relevant and it's going to get us into talking about our elders. And, you know, the first time that we had finally connected, I remember, you know, I was visiting one of my best friends and their mom lives with them. And, you know, I had said to their mom, like, I got to go get on a work call. I'll be right back. Right. I'm going to go take this call, do what I got to do. And so, you know, I got on the phone with you and we're starting to have this conversation. And a couple of minutes into it, their mom busts into the room and is looking at me. Right. And, you know, soon enough sits down on the bed, takes their hand, outstretches it to me, and there's a phone, like an iPhone.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yes, in it. And I was on the phone with you. Okay. Right, I was like, yeah, I was like, I think that I gotta go right now. And I'm like, I'm not quite sure, like, exactly what's happening. And it turns out, you know, she was closing on a house. She's like in her 70s, and she couldn't figure out how to use DocuSign.
Yeah.
And so I ended up spending like the rest of my day, like sitting there and like on the phone trying to be like, can we get it sent to this email address? And, you know, doing electronic signatures and doing all of these things. And I literally remember, no joke, I talked to my therapist about this because I was like, what? Like, it was a moment in time in my life where I was sitting around thinking about, what am I prioritizing, right? What are the things that are important to me and that I'm making a lot of time and space for? And it was one of the first times that I was saying, like, you know, family is really important to me. Elders are really important to me. And so in that moment, having to make that decision of like, I gotta go. And I was like, I really hope that Timneet understands and doesn't think that I am just like the biggest flake on the planet.
I'm glad you went. Yeah.
The house is closed. Everything went well.
Everything's good.
Everything is good. And right, I remember having that sort of, you know, feeling and saying, I didn't know you that well. And I was like, I don't know if you'll understand that, you know, when an elder comes to me and asks for help.
I remember it was a few years ago. It's like 2022 or 23.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but it was like, I think it was during the shutdown, like maybe 2021 or 22. I don't remember.
I don't remember either. Yeah, but it was one of those moments. And I think, you know, having gone through that, I'm so happy to sit down and be able to have this conversation with you more about technology and elders and what it means and what it can look like to, you know, build technology that serves and honors our ancestors. I want to talk first about a New York Times op-ed that you wrote. I want to say, I should have looked at the exact date, but it was this year, correct? Am I making that up?
I think it was released this year or no, it was the end of last year because it was like a reflection of 2024, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was released kind of maybe around November or December of 24.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. So you asked this question. You asked a couple questions in there that I want to talk to you a little bit about, but you asked this question of who is tech really for historically, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Who is that?
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Because, you know, I think I was thinking about these people make me forget that I am a technologist, you know, like I studied electrical engineering. I liked math and physics. That's what I got into tech to do. And mm-hmm. here I am constantly having to tell, to just say, don't do this, don't do that. And I was just like, no, that's not what I want my career to be. But the reason is that all of the activities that I think are fun, you know, versus the stuff that those activities lead to. I think math and physics are fun. I think that building tech is fun. I think debugging, the way you have to think about, you know, the way you have to think in logical sequences, all of the activities about the space that I studied were interesting to me and fun. And however, the things that I was building using those activities, you know, I just never had the opportunity to think about what they are and who they serve, because kind of the norm is, you know, you go to school and you are so busy trying to figure out the technical details that you're not thinking about the big picture. You don't have time to do that. Like, you have all of these classes you have to take, you're drowning, and then, you know, people are discriminating against you and you're fighting that and all of that. And then you go to the next thing, and then you can't ever take a step back and say, wait a minute, you know, what am I building and what am I contributing to? And in my engineering education, I also did not get exposed to people who are asking that, you know, like there are whole fields of people and scholars asking this question. So then, of course, you know, now it's very clear who tech is for. I mean, I took it for granted that, for example, in all of my classes, I remember that it had something to do with the military, but it was just sort of as a, you know, taken as a fact. Like, it's not something to critique or think about it, or to think that it could be something different. The C programming language, oh, that was developed because the military, the internet, it was, the military, you know, and it's just, oh, interesting. It seems like the military has a lot to do with this. Thank God that the military gives money to, at least, you know. So you don't get a chance to think maybe there's a different way. It doesn't have to be this way. So, yeah. So when we look at who tech is for, especially now with AI and what, you know, OpenAI and all these people are doing, we're living in someone else's imagination, right? A few people who have lots of money imagine what could be done, what they want to do, how they want to live, what kind of world they want to live in. And then they get money and they get power to execute on that imagination, and or empires want to make sure they have their grip on empires and execute on that imagination. So, you know, if we take a step back and we follow the scholars who have, you know, given us some things to think about, then we arrive at this conclusion, and then we can arrive at a conclusion that we could do something differently.
Okay, so much in there to unpack. This thing that you said about living in someone else's imagination, right? I tell folks that one of my favorite things that I used to do when I worked inside of industry, and we had all hands meetings, and we got to see like inside of exec houses, look at their bookshelves, right? And see what books they had on their bookshelves. And inevitably, it was some like science fiction book, you know, written by some white guy who was,
Not like old. Octavia Butler.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so I made it a habit to start reading those books, right? And to see what are these futures that these folks are actually trying to build, and asking the question, like, does it include me? Right. It does that. Does that thing, like, because here's kind of like the blueprint that's sitting on the bookshelf, right?
Yeah.
Am I included in that? And I think that was something that was like, you know, absolutely continued to, it was one of my favorite things to do when I was sitting inside of companies, because it really is that sort of these imaginations that are so small, right? And I think you've also said something about, you know, in the roles that so many of us are placed in, and I feel this so deeply in the policy world, that like what we get to do is sit around and say, don't do this, please don't do that. We spend our time so much in the sort of reactive stance that we don't get to have our own imaginations, right? We don't get to have our own sort of ability to look into the future and think, what could this look like? So in this piece that you wrote for the New York Times, you inserted this question that was, what would an internet that served my elders look like? When I read that, I literally remember I like pulled out my phone and messaged you, because it felt like a gut punch, right? It was just like, yes, that is a question that I had never heard anybody ask before. What made you ask that question?
It was based on, you know, similar to your podcast, we talked about this before. We started a possible future series, and that's kind of how.
Shout out to Dylan.
Dylan, the connector.
Right.
Yeah. And the reason we started this series was exactly what you said before. We're sitting around being reactive, and not, why shouldn't we live in our own imagination if we're living in someone else's imagination? And if we're always being reactive, we're not giving ourselves the chance to think about that and execute on that instead. We're always going to be in reactive mode. We're not going to be able to forge what we think should be forged. So this possible future series was a way for our own team, and maybe some others, a few other people, to have a structured way of thinking about, have space for us to imagine and think about how we can execute on that imagination. So we had to have a little bit of structure, right? Like, it's not so, you know, speculative that it's so far, you know, it's kind of like we have a little bit of a structure in there and guidance. So in this one, I was thinking, so it was me, Alex, Hannah, and Asma Lashteka, who's our fellow who wrote it. And I was thinking about how whenever we talk about tech, I mean, I have this kind of conversation with people a lot. They talk about digital literacy. How can we, the idea is that people first have to change themselves in some way, and then they can use the tech for something, right? It's never about, you know, every single human being as they are in this world should have tools that improve their lives in some way. That's not the philosophy. The philosophy is that, you know, there's this thing that'll improve your life in some way, but you first have to change yourself in it and to be able to use that tool. And so I've been thinking about this because it's kind of like a paradigm in the tech industry. And I remember, I think I was reading a Paris Marx's book, The Road to Nowhere, and there was an example of like some Princeton students talking about how, so there's, you know, of course the future should have self-driving cars. That's just a given, right? From these people, the self-drive, but there's a lot of problems.
Like the Jetsons, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of problems. The future should have self-driving cars. And so, but there's a lot of obstacles to making that happen. One of them is obviously people walking walking around the street as we do, as one does, preventing the self-driving car from just driving around. So how do we prevent that obstacle? And it's like, oh, maybe every person, every human can wear this like tag. I don't know if it's, I don't remember like what it was based on, but some tag that then communicates with the car. And each of these tags would cost like $2,000 or something. And so this was the proposal, right? And like the so-called best minds of America are, you know, pontificating about how to make sure that each person wears some like $2,000 thing, because that's the way to potentially make self-driving cars exist. That's just kind of like the logical conclusion of the paradigm we're in, which is the assumption is this thing has to exist. It has to exist. How do people, you know, change themselves? And I was thinking about it also, you know, we had a similar possible futures workshop like a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. And sir.
Oh, yay. So, you know, we were talking about this and I was thinking about, again, you go back to that philosophy. So, you know, what for someone to go on the train or for someone to go on the bus, I think the assumption isn't that they need to change something about themselves. If you're it shouldn't be. If you're a wheelchair user, you use a wheelchair, you go on the bus. If you're an elder, you have your cane, you go on the bus or you go on the train. There's systems, there's, you know, if it's broken, mm-hmm. like there's ways in which to figure that out. But a car is different. We all have to be little pilots, right? It's like all of us have, it doesn't make any sense to me, because imagine if every single person could, you know, fly a plane and all these planes flying around and all of these rules, it just makes no sense. And I imagine back to when people imagined cars as a dominant mode of transportation. Yeah. And first we all have to learn how to, you know, drive cars, and then everybody has to know the rules and not drive fast, but not kill. I mean, it's just, you know, it's meant for you to drive fast, but you can't drive fast because you're going to kill people. And the whole, all of society has to be remade to accommodate the existence of cars. Yeah. You know, I never thought, like, even back to when I was thinking about so-called responsible AI or responsible data model practices, etc. I remember even from 2017, I had a TED talk, and I gave this example of how it took a long time for seatbelts to be a norm. People resisted them, car companies resisted them, etc. But if I were to do that talk again, that's not even what I would talk about. I would talk about how
What would cars, you talk about?
I would talk about how cars came to be the dominant mode of transportation. Whose imagination was that? And how it doesn't make sense. You know, it's kind of, you know, when I read Paris's book. So now, going back to the whole elders thing, you know, again, public transportation, trains, buses, that is an assumption that you don't have to change how you are, right? Like you should have this mode of transportation available to you without changing who you are. And so, whereas like the idea of cars, it's, oh, individual freedom. I can just, you know, like I don't have to be around other people. Like, I don't have to see the masses. I can just, you know, take off and whenever, you know.
Very American. Very American.
Yeah. And then you have to plant that imagination into people, and you have to fight all of these politicians and get in their pockets to make sure it happens. You have to destroy Black neighborhoods to build highways. And, you know, it's just like all of society's remade and suburbs are born, you know. And so when we think about the internet, it's kind of the same. It's like there is this idea when you think about it, or tech in general, who's mm-hmm. the quintessential tech user? Oh, are you tech savvy or are you not? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not, oh, is there tech that works for anyone as they are? Is that what we're building? And so now we make fun of, you know, older people when they can't use the TV well, or when they can't use the phone, or when they can't, you know, figure out how to do something on social media, but we're not making fun of ourselves for not building something that doesn't work for them.
Yeah, that isn't user-friendly, right? Especially thinking about like who our users are, who users of technology are. We're talking a little bit about elders, of course, and I would love to ask if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about some of your elders that inspired you to write and think about a lot of these things.
So in this one piece about our internet for our elders, I was, you know, thinking about, for example, I mentioned earlier, my mother tongue is Tigrinya. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the assumption is that, oh, no one should care about people speaking this language or only this language because it's only a certain portion of languages. Why should I care about them when there's all these other people who speak all these other languages? Mm-hmm. And that you probably would relate to this. I mean, given where you worked before, but that attitude is why we have one of those, the reasons we have so many such toxic online experience for so many groups of people around the world, including, you know, a genocide that's fueled by social media, you know, language that spreads like fire on social media, like when we talk about the Rohingya or the genocide of Tigrayans. That's kind of when I really started thinking about it, is because I've read a lot about these kinds of issues, and I never really cared about social media. I'm not a social media researcher. But when you start seeing the toxicity, the level of toxicity in your own language, then you really understand what we're dealing with. You know, it's when I read about the Rohingya, it doesn't hit as much as home as when I see it in my context and my languages and I try to report it and then what happens. And it's literally, well, you know, these people don't really bring in ad revenue. How can we, you know, dedicate this many resources to them when they're only like 10 million people in the world? There's, you know, 8 billion people in the world. Like, that's not a very widely spoken language and all of that. And so that, and then we end up with, you know, basically the deadliest genocide of the 21st century thus far, where over a million people have been killed. Imagine 1 million out of 7, right? At least 300,000 victims of rape as a weapon of war, etc. And whenever I tried to talk about this and get people to care, it was like, well, again, you know, why should I care about that one, like, little tiny small group of people, you know? And so we started working on language technology, even to do this analysis of social media platforms, et cetera. We had to do this language technology, work on language tech, and I had to learn how to justify why I'm working on that specific language tech, you know, out of all the other, you know, other languages and everything. And then that led me to think about, you know, why shouldn't I center specific communities that I know that I'm from? Why should they not have what other people have? And then that's got me thinking, like, I'm thinking, you know, about my grandmother, you know, my grandmother not only spoke Tigrinya, but she didn't read or write. And now supposedly with the whole digital literacy thing, it's, if someone doesn't read or write, it's, oh, they're a lost cause. They shouldn't even have tech that, you know, other illiterate, like, first they have to be literate and then they can use tech kind of thing, you know, but there's all these people, oral cultures are very rich cultures. So why shouldn't she have tech that met her needs as she was? And so that's kind of how I started thinking about these things in my work, where I kind of started thinking about the philosophy that I see that's widespread, that's taken as a given, and how it really causes harm to so many, to communities that I know that I'm from.
Yeah. Thank you for talking a little bit about that. It does really resonate with me. I think about my own grandparents, my grandfather also couldn't read or write, right? And so I think about, he's now an ancestor, but, you know, what his experience of technology would have been like, what he wouldn't have been able to participate, right, in so many of the pieces of this. And I also think about my grandmother, who's also passed. But you mentioned, you know, wheelchairs, canes, these systems that were actually technology systems, right, that were created to meet people where they were at. You know, my grandmother was blind and in a wheelchair and had all of these, you know, these systems of technology that were helpful for her in so many ways. But I think about, you know, the internet, social media, like, these, it's not them, right? Like, these are not the same thing.
Yeah, the idea is that these things that are not for them, it's like they first have to upgrade themselves in some way. And yeah. then they can have, you know, that's a really unspoken sort of rule in tech. And then, you know, if you want to work on tech that works for specific groups of people, then you have to specialize in things like accessibility. It's not, you know, it's not the right. norm. It's not the foundation. I do accessibility. So that's the part that gets to think about disabled people of all the different kinds of disabilities. That's mm-hmm. basically a majority of the world, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you really mm-hmm. think about it. And so, you know, sure, if you are the quintessential, you know, internet user, you basically are the person who, you know, has hegemonic views. You have all mm-hmm. the money to build tech. So, you know, white dudes right. Silicon Valley or whatever, who get all them. Again, it's their imagination that's being implemented, right? So they'll build something that kind of follows whatever ideology that they want to follow. And then the idea is that that has to work for everybody around the world. And mm-hmm. if, you know, we don't meet that, if we're not like that in some way, then first we have to change ourselves and then we
right. can. Yeah. This piece on changing yourself or having to upgrade yourself in a certain way in order to be able to engage with technology, I think is really interesting, especially with this phrase that you used in the piece that you wrote in the Possible Future series, along with your colleagues, referring to grandmothers as technologies of memory themselves, right? What did you mean when you said that? And can you explain a little bit more about how calling someone a technology and being a technology while also experiencing technologies or can be, you know, these different things.
Yeah, you know, I never really thought about this. You know, it's like you think about things when they're scarce, I think. So now any elder I have, like my uncles or something, I spend, you know, I try to spend as much time as I can with them because they're my connection to like whatever villages my, you know, grandparents are from, all of the information about these things and all the knowledge, all the hyper local knowledge that they have. And the fact that, you know, we have oral cultures means that you only get that knowledge when you're with them, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't have access to that knowledge when you're not with them. It's very interesting, like a gatekeeping mechanism too, right? Yeah. Like it's like data protection. You know? Yeah, like only the people who have access to these people have that knowledge. And so they tell you all of these stories about the past, about the present, about your family members and how you related to everybody. I mean, I don't understand how this is possible. They have a social graph that goes back generations. I mean, it is incredible. I've never seen anything like it. My brain doesn't work that way. I guess I lost that part of it. I don't know. Any person on the street, you know, they'll be like, the way we're related to that person is. And then 20 minutes later, you're like, oh my God, I need to record this, you know? I can't remember, you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
ancestry. Yeah.
It's very interesting. And so, you know, and a lot of history is also recorded through poetry, there's all these sayings, different phrases that, and, you know, and so you only get access to that knowledge from your elders. And it's something very unique. And I only kind of think more about it as I'm growing older too. Mm-hmm. And I know like I only have limited time with these elders of mine.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that the sort of the ticking time clock as your folks start to age and you can see that happening and you want to be able to, you know, capture the memories that they hold. You talked a little bit about how much of our cultures are oral cultures and how much of, you know, our histories are stored through poetry. You asked a series of questions in your piece, and I'm going to ask you these questions because I want to know what you think about them too. But you said, you know, how can the internet bring us closer to family and enable the transfer of wisdom, kindness, and community held by our grandmothers? And one of the things I was thinking about was like, of course, oral history projects, right? Like, what would that look like if that was the foundation of our internet?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, I would say that one thing I like about this possible future series just for myself is that it put me in a space of thinking about this. Mm-hmm. And so, and then based on this piece, we spun out a bunch of research projects.
Yeah. Really? Tell me more.
Yeah, for real. It, you know, I don't know if it would have happened if we didn't just put ourselves in this position of thinking about these things. So one of them is a collaboration with, do you know Whose Knowledge? There's an organization called Whose Knowledge.
Tell our listeners who might not know who that is.
It's a great organization, and they just basically interrogate like Whose Knowledge is represented online, you know, on the internet, etc. And so we collaborated with them on, we're collaborating currently with them on this research project. And it's called Sovereign Language Technologies for Online Knowledge Repositories. So, you know, you're talking about oral history project, you know, what does it look like to have an online knowledge repository? So for example, Wikipedia is an example of an online knowledge repository, right? So initially we started saying, you know, Wikipedia is really not useful in many languages. Like it's mm-hmm. full of misinformation. It doesn't have any, you know, locally relevant information, etc. So when we did some research looking into why, some of the Wikipedia editors on in some of these languages said that they don't have appropriate language tech tools. Like they don't even have spell checkers. They don't have keyboards. They would like to have speech to text transcription tools that allows them to speak and transcribe text, etc. Yeah. And then we were like, okay, let's work on that. And then we were like, wait a minute, Wikipedia might not even be the right form for some of these, like what for some of these, you know, cultures. Like, what if there's an oral kind of, you know, mm-hmm. Wikipedia? What about an oral archive? Maybe someone can edit the, you know, archive orally or something. And so then we started doing, we went backwards and we're like, okay, what should the form of the online knowledge repository look like? Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what are language technologies that we can have to support people in having those forms? So that's kind of what we're doing research in right now.
That's fascinating that these questions have been able to spin out into research and to say, so that's so much of, you know, what I'm trying and hoping to do with this podcast and these conversations that we're having. You know, policy is a, you know, deep and sometimes philosophical, right? And
yeah,
we take ourselves so seriously, right? Mm-hmm. And what if we take a step back sometimes and think about things like joy or community or elders, and what space can that open up to create things like research projects or new policy ideas, right?
Like I can tell you another research project. That's And the other one is the idea that, you know, so I mentioned that I kind of have to justify why I put resources in language technology for Tigrinya, because, mm-hmm. those are just like 10 million, you know, people or whatever. What about this other language? What about this other language?
So, just 10 million people.
Exactly. That's it. In the span of, you know, not exactly, you know, in the grand scheme of things, who cares, right? And so... And that's always going to be the attitude for most groups of people. So mm-hmm. most groups of people are collections of groups of like a certain, you know, number of people, whether it is 10 million or 1 million, whatever. And then that collection sort of expands to the world, right? Most groups of people are not just, you know, lumped into 1 billion people who do X. And so I was thinking, you know, and I was speaking with a number of our fellows and other people about, if you wanted to create tools that serve as many people as possible, you're not going to do it by becoming a monopoly and like doing everything, you know, building mm-hmm. language tech for every single language in the world. I will be the person to do that. And that's kind of what the OpenAIs and the Facebooks and the, you know, Metas and the Googles and stuff claim. We have mm-hmm. one thing that'll serve all of these.
One size fits all. Yeah.
One model for everyone. One size fits all. Mm-hmm. And so what's the opposite of that? It's okay. Many sizes for many people. Just similarly to how I had to, you know, justify why I'm working on this language or, you know, some other language that I know. If there is one small company or one small organization, one such organization is Lesan, and the founder of Lesan, Asma, is one of the authors of that piece, and he's a fellow at DAIR. So he focuses on Ethiopian and Eritrean languages, just a few of them, not even all of them. There's like 100 of them. And at least he started focusing with the languages he knows. And he started, because he knows the context and the community, he created really a language technology that outperform anybody, any big text language technology, because A, he cares about those people, and B, he knows the context, so he'll create something better. And, you know, he cares about the quality because he cares about those people. Whereas right. for Google, it's a 10 million group of people. They don't bring in any money. So if we want to replicate that for multiple groups of people, we want to have multiple lessons, right? Where each of them are not trying to like become monopolies, but they're trying to build products for this, you know, a small group of people, or relatively small group of people that they know, not really small, right? And so we're working on this federation of small language technology startups and orgs to start within in the African context, because there's 3,000 of the world's 7,000 languages are spoken in the one third, not 3,000, but one third of the world's 7,000 languages are spoken in the African continent, at least. So we're working on this federation to have a bunch of small language tech startups that each focus on a small number of languages so that they don't become monopolies. And that means, because if you try to, you know, increase your linguistic coverage, you're going to decrease the quality, right, of each language. And then, but if you're just a single company, you can't really survive as a small business, because some other company is going to come, well, I need coverage, you know, in these 10 languages that you don't have, you know, and oh, sorry, if you, Facebook has it, you know, even though it's bad quality.
It's not good. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is another kind of thing that we're working on with a number of other partners of ours.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit about the research that is really like very tangible, right? Research that has come out of just the process of sitting back and giving ourselves the ability to no longer just be in that reactive space, right? But to imagine and think about what we could potentially create. You mentioned misinformation, and I can't, we got to talk about the elders and misinformation. And the WhatsApp aunties and the conversations that we're having. Yeah. I will say, as you're talking to my same friend, mom, you know, is an immigrant to the United States, and was telling me about, you know, this video that she had seen, and, you know, it was saying that, you know, these immigrants aren't welcome in these cities, whatever. And I finally was like, let me see this. And I look at it, and it's completely AI generated. You know what I mean?
Like, oh my God.
Voice is like robot voice. I check out the YouTube channel, and it's just video after video targeting immigrant communities specifically, trying to stir up this. And so, you know, I sit down and have this conversation, and I'm like, you know, the companies don't have protections for folks that are at the margins. And so therefore these things are being beta tested. Right. And then of course, you know, we have to go back to the WhatsApp group to say, we looked it up and this isn't true. So you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Dispelling the information. And I think that it is something that is hard and something that we don't necessarily talk about enough.
This is exactly, and to me, another instance of what we talked about, where, oh, why should we care about this one community? And therefore, you know, so it's like, oh, this is just one specific diaspora group. And so I'm not going to spend my time talking about, you know, misinformation in this one language, because it only affects this one community. But then actually the same thing in all these different forums is happening to many different communities, which collectively create, you know,
yes,
a big group of people. So it is happening a lot in so many ways. It's hard because you can't, it's like you have to find all of these different ways of alerting other people about it and why they should care. Hey, this is happening. And like you said, if, you know, this is happening with one group of people and they're a testing ground. And so if you don't care about this one group of people, this is what's coming to you. Or, you know, this is, that happened when I was working at Google. I remember one of the people who worked under us was Mahdi, who's a Moroccan journalist and computer scientist. So he got his PhD in computer science, but he was a journalist before that. And he was telling us that YouTube, the most popular YouTube and Facebook channels, were arms of the intelligence unit.
Oh, wow.
And they were like taking people's private information and publishing it. They were doing all sorts of things. And when we tried to alert, I mean, even when I was at Google, like YouTube was like everything that we sent there never heard back, you know, and they would be like, sorry, we're focused on the U.S. election right now. Sure, the U.S. election is very important. We care. I care. I'm in the U.S. I care about the U.S. election, but you're operating in a lot of different countries around the world. So this teammate of ours, his friend, Omar Radi, as a journalist, was imprisoned, and he was one of the first victims of NSO's group's Pegasus, like the spyware.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? Pegasus was used all over the world, and this person was one of the first victims, the government, etc., you know. And I remember El Salvadorian journalists are talking about this too. Like, oh, now you guys get to see what we've been saying about our leader, you know, now that people in the U.S. are being sent to El Salvador. So it's the same story over and over again. You know, this one group of people, we shouldn't care about them because they're a minority. We have to care about the majority, and we have to, you know, we can't care about this specific one specific context, et cetera, et cetera. And in so many different ways, we see the fact that, you know, this one specific context, A, we should care about it because they're people, and we should care about all people as they are. Right. And B, because there's no hierarchy of human life. And B, this one context is always a testing ground. If you allow this to happen, that means you're living in a world where this one thing is happening. So this example that you're talking about of, you know, specifically older immigrant communities, diasporic communities, it's something.
It's a beta test. I was like, oh,
I see this all the time, over and over again, in so many different ways. And so, I was thinking similar to the Federation of Language Tech Startups that we were working on. I've been talking to other journalist friends of mine, et cetera. I'm like, you know, maybe a bunch of different communities like that should form an alliance and have a block that is more powerful so that they can, you know, whether it's lobbying the companies or lobbying the government. Because if you go to which government? I don't even, well, but I'm just saying, because usually if you go, you know, if I go to someone on behalf of, you know, Tigrinya speaking elders in the U.S., they'll be like, why should I care about this one little, marginal group of people? But if we all, of so many different groups like that, form, you know, some sort of alliance, then we can kind of talk about common, you know, issues that we have.
Yeah. I think that piece on, you know, not enough people for anyone to care also goes into this piece that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation around whose imagination are we living in, right? Because if it's your world and it's your family and it's you, right, and your people, you're going to be concerned. But if it's those folks over there, you know, who cares, right? Who cares if this thing is being beta tested and eventually is going to come and impact our communities? Another question I have for you, and we'll wrap it up soon here, is talking to elders about technology, talking to elders about AI. I would love any recommendations you have for us about this. I will say again, I love this lady so much. Same person, you know, I didn't realize.
Does she know she's like your running example?
I told her, I was like, I don't know, I'm going to talk about you on a podcast. She was like, what? But love her enough. Shout out to her. She watches soap operas during the day, like so many human beings. And I was sitting down watching them once and realized that there was this whole storyline about an AI deepfake revenge porn that was happening inside of The Bold and the Beautiful. Wow. And I was sitting there, oh my gosh, I think that this is how this individual is being introduced to the concept of AI. And like you literally said, you know, I said something to her that I was like, this is AI. And she's like, AI who? And I'm like, exactly, right? But it is that sort of like, how do we have these conversations, right? Like, how do we explain these things that are completely, you know, outside of their realm, or, you know, the sort of knowledge and information that they're getting is coming from really weird sources.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard because it's a lot of disinformation. So, you know, I've been very frustrated, for example, with 60 Minutes, CBS 60 Minutes. A lot of older people watch CBS 60 Minutes. I was on there once and I barely had any airtime. Most of the airtime was for Microsoft CEO. And so, you know, that's to me, press release best grading is journalism. Yeah. So, you know, if the press is going to be kind of just doing lip service for these CEOs who have a vested interest in a specific narrative, then that is the narrative that, forget elders, not just elders, but a lot of most people are hearing from. So what we need is accurate information to be seeded into many of these spaces that people... So I know that Tamara Neese from Data and Society went on Teen Vogue. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, she had an article on Teen Vogue about, you know, climate change and AI, because that is where teenagers are going.
That's where people are. Yeah.
Or, you know, TikTok. If that's, you know, there's some academics who are really good at, you know, all the social media channels. I don't know. I think Kelsey Feis, I don't know how to say her last name properly, Feisler. I'm not sure. But I see her on all the social media channels, having explainers, doing all this stuff, because that's where people are. So, you know, accurate information needs to be seeded wherever any group of people get, wherever they get their information. And it's very difficult to fight the disinformation and misinformation because, you know who is resourced and who isn't.
Right, right. There's a misinformation works. Like it wouldn't, people wouldn't spend so much money on disinformation if it didn't work and if it didn't work tremendously well. And I think it's something that, you know, we have to keep in mind, and especially thinking about our elders and how they are being targeted, you know, specifically by so much of this. I know that you are writing a book. I'd love to end off our conversation a little bit talking about this question of, you know, we're building these technological futures. How do we build a technological future that serves our communities, our elders, and our grandmothers?
Well, I don't know if the book title is going to stay the same. Who knows? But the current one is like, it starts, you know, the view from somewhere. And it's kind of a call back to, you know, Donna Haraway's The View from Nowhere, you know, feminist critique of the way in which we learn, especially at least in the Western world, about, you know, science and tech as being from no one's point of view. It's like the, you know, it's just the truth out there, or the next evolution, the next inevitable evolution. Like, obviously there was horses and then steam engines and then cars and then self-driving cars and then flying cars. You know, this is the natural progression of things. And first, we have to really understand that there is no natural progression of things. It is all of it is about who is getting the resources to execute on what imagination. A bunch of people created a Discord server for people interested in this possible futures thing at our like possible futures community. And I was telling them that I would love to create like an alternative curriculum for, you know, computer science students or engineering students. What if my education was different? How would I want it, and how would I want it to be different? Like, in what way? Well, I would have wanted to be indoctrinated, not in this is the way it is, but more, hey, remember that this is someone else's imagination, and this is what this imagination is driven by. Like, you were reading the sci-fi books. And I had to do the same kind of thing, be like, why are people obsessed with this AGI thing? And a philosopher, Emil, and I wrote this, you know, paper on where we coined the term the test grill bundle. It was like, wow, eugenics, this is what they're motivated by. So understanding that, you know, I hate having to spend time reading what these people are writing. I feel like, my God, this is not what I want to spend my time doing. But understanding that foundation at least allows you to be like, wow, these are the principles they're instituting, and what are the principles that I'm interested in? The first thing has to be understanding the fact that we're living in someone else's imagination and how that is so. Then then we can continue to ask, okay, so what are principles that we care about? So for me, it's Alex Hanantina Park wrote this paper against scale when Alex was actually in our team at Google. And it was like the whole scale, Silicon Valley scale thinking is that this one size fits all thing. Yeah. And whereas, for example, the federation that I'm thinking we're working on is the complete opposite of that. It's like you achieve so-called scale, but that's not by, you know, having one thing for everyone. That's having by having many things for many people.
Yeah.
And when you think about movements too and how they spread, it's not by one person, I don't know, leading a movement for the whole world. Like it's one person starting something in one place and that spreads and it gets adopted by somebody else in another place. I mean, that's how things change, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I would think about. It's first thinking about, you know, whose imagination we're living in. Secondly, giving ourselves space to figure out what principles we care about and what, you know, like how we can all use our skills to build on those principles. And three, resourcing. I mean, let's just money, okay?
Yeah.
Money. And we're always talking up there, you know, and okay, let's get back down to earth.
Yeah.
Resourcing and funding the people whose imaginations we agree with, who we think should be instituted. And so, you know, Sam Altman, you know, builds something bad and fails. But when he fails and we build something bad, he takes the whole world with him and he has billions and trillions and whatever. The rest of us should be able to get to prototype things, even if they fail, even if it was a mistake or whatever. But we should be able to experiment and prototype on the things we're imagining at a small scale. And we should be able to resource people to do that. For instance, Rudy Fraser, he's working on Black Sky, right?
Yeah.
He's been doing this stuff. He told me unpaid, like literally he's spending money out of his savings doing that. I'm like, that's not acceptable. It's not okay. We should resource people like him.
Yeah.
That's, I'm just, you know, lots, so many examples like that. And so, you know, let's not just resource people to be reactive and talk about the, you know, the issues. Let's resource them in executing on their imagination.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Timmy, for joining us and for giving us those three really actionable items that we can do to continue to build a future that would honor and serve our elders and our ancestors. It was really wonderful speaking with you today.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to Anika, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.